Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, Bobby Kennedy, the making of a liberal icon. My guest is Larry Tai. That's his new book. He's been a guest on the program before, talking about some of his books, including Superman, a book about Superman, the history of. His new book is, the title, Bobby Kennedy, the Making of a Liberal Icon. I should say that Larry and I are friends for way too long to admit. We were part of a journalism fellowship program together many, many years ago, the Nieman Fellowship. So, Larry Tai, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back with you, David.
Bobby Kennedy, the making of a liberal icon. Let's break that up a little bit. Talk to me about, you know, Bobby Kennedy, 48 years after his death, he is still a liberal icon. You still have these very odd bedfellows who he's a hero to, everyone from the predictable liberals to Bill O'Reilly of Fox News. Why is he such an icon?
He's an icon to those two different groups because he was two different Bobby Kennedys, or he was a Bobby Kennedy always in the making. And what I mean by that is this guy who ended up being the ultimate hero of liberals, of minorities, of a whole range of people without power, started out life as a protege of the table-thumping, red-hunting Senator Joseph P. McCarthy. And he did that not just because McCarthy and his dad were buddies and Bobby needed a job, but because Bobby believed that the only person in Washington who was going after what Kennedy believed then was a very real threat of communism was Joe McCarthy. And he saw a threat not just in the Soviet Union, but like McCarthy, behind just about every pillar at the State Department.
The making of is your subtitle, The Making of a Liberal Icon, and the book goes into, you know, really unbelievable detail about that period of his life that many folks who hold on to the, you know, the liberal image of Bobby Kennedy. He wouldn't have gotten us into Vietnam. He would have solved civil rights. He would have done this. He would have done that. It's a part of his life that has been sort of forgotten, whitewashed, as if it never happened. Why is that the case?
I think that's the case for two reasons. One is that we have short memories, and we generally know the last image of any famous person. That's the one we walk away with. So Bobby Kennedy, in most people's mind, will be always the 42-year-old Bobby Kennedy who died putting together this extraordinary bridge-building campaign for president. We also know only the later Bobby Kennedy because that's what the Kennedy myth-making machine wanted us to know, that family and all of the wonderful Kennedy partisans over the years wrote off as a footnote or an aberration the Joe McCarthy period, when in fact it was neither. It was a very important piece of who he was at the beginning, and I think he could never have become the liberal icon that he did at the end unless he had gone through that transformation. And that was also what let him, in the end, build a coalition between what we would today call angry white Trump voters and the liberals and minorities and others that are part of Hillary Clinton's coalition. And Bobby Kennedy actually, for a brief period back in 1968, offered the promise of bringing together blue collars and blacks and browns and people of every shade.
You are an exhaustive researcher, and you know, you talk about the myth-making machinery of the Kennedys. Your research has led you to burst a lot of those myths, to pop a lot of those wishful bubbles. Talk to me about the research and what, you know, you did, including interviewing Ethel Kennedy. And talk to me about some of the bubbles that you burst.
Sure. So let's start with the research. And what I did, David, is what you or any reporter would do. You go out there and you look for everything that you can find. And that meant interviewing more than 400 people. It meant looking through 80 or so boxes of newly opened papers that happened to open up just about the day I began my research at the Kennedy Library that the Kennedy family had never allowed the public to see before that. It involved going out and reading 500 books and tens of thousands of articles, everything that had ever been written on him. And thankfully, I was doing my research. It took me 3 years to do this book, and it would have taken three times that much time had I been doing it when I was writing my first books, when there wasn't an internet out there, and when it was more difficult to find information, to find all the articles, all the books, and all the people. And the fact is that I was able to interview people that had never talked before. I would like to tell you, because I'm more charming than people who had taken on projects like
this. I know that's not true.
Yes, exactly. So I don't have to tell you that. But the truth is, I went out there at a perfect moment of things coming together, and that was most of the people that I wanted to talk to were still alive, still had their memories, and yet there was nobody there to circle the wagons anymore. All the Kennedy myth protectors were gone, and so people decided on their own, not because somebody told them and called them and said, don't talk to this guy, decided on their own whether to talk to me. And with people like Ethel Kennedy, who had generally done all she could in the last 50 years to avoid reporters and authors, with her, I showed up on her doorstep at the magical moment where she realized it was me or nobody, and I looked better than nobody. And people just were extraordinary. The good news is that I got to more than 400 people. The bad news is that in the 3 years I wrote the book, at least a third of those people, including an extraordinary guy named Anthony Lewis, are no longer here. And I was getting to people late enough in life, often when they were not well, but they were amazing. And your father, the famous New York Times columnist, who had covered Bobby Kennedy and who had started out as a Bobby Kennedy skeptic and ended up as a Bobby Kennedy friend and admirer, people like that, including him, just told wonderful stories. And they were stories that helped me, as you described it, puncture a few myths. And if I can, I'll just tell you a couple stories about the things. Bobby Kennedy was a Zelig-like character who showed up seemingly in the center of every important issue of his era, from civil rights to the Bay of Pigs, from the Cuban Missile Crisis to the Vietnam War. And one myth, and sort of a representative myth, was that Bobby Kennedy was the great dove during the Vietnam War who helped talk his brother and the whole cabinet and power structure into going with the option of blockading Cuba. Russia puts missiles in Cuba. We demand that they take the missiles out much too close for our comfort. And Jack Kennedy decides on this middle ground of a blockade instead of an air attack or instead of doing nothing. And that turns out to be the perfect middle ground. And it looks like the Russians and the Cubans back down, and Bobby Kennedy is right next to his brother, the hero. And we think he's the hero of that because that's the story he told us. The first insider look at what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis was in a book and subsequent movie that were made based on Bobby Kennedy's book called 13 Days. And it took us through the 13 days where the world came the closest to a nuclear war that has ever come in the history of the world. And that was a great story. And it was a great story that Bobby Kennedy had all to himself because he was the only insider who told that story. And it would have been an even better story if it were true. The truth of the missile crisis is that we got into it not because Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro decided one day we're going to put missiles in Cuba and we're going to really try to do something to tick off America. They put missiles in Cuba because for a year before that, Bobby Kennedy had been spearheading a secret war against Cuba called Operation Mongoose, where in the wake of the Bay of Pigs, we decided we were going to do anything we could to sabotage Castro's regime and, by the way, if we could, to assassinate him in the process. That was why the Russians rightfully thought the only way we can ensure the safety of Castro in Cuba is to go in there and do something dramatic like put missiles there. So Bobby Kennedy helped get us into the crisis, and for the first several days of the crisis, he was out there along with guys like Curtis LeMay, who your listeners might recognize as the Dr. Strangelove character in the movies, they were out there arguing. Bobby Kennedy was vociferously and effectively arguing for an airstrike, for let's go invade Cuba, and at a minimum, we'll bomb the heck out of them. And that was who he started out as. The fact that later on during the crisis, he became more of a dove and went along with the blockade that his brother probably would have supported from day one is interesting, and it's just not part of the story that Bobby told. And he got away with telling his version because that was the only version we had. What I can't quite understand is why he didn't get that the secret tapes that Jack and Bobby had put in the White House cabinet room, I guess he never thought those would become public. And those became public in a way that we could see that Bobby's version of the story, while serving his purposes perfectly in his wanting to run for Senate and for president, was not the truth. And we know the truth because we have his words on tape. And that was one of many things where he spun the truth just enough to make the Kennedys look even better than they would have looked otherwise. One last thing on the missile crisis that he lied about. The story, as Bobby told it, and the official story for decades, was that we told the Russians to take the missiles out of Cuba, and they stood down. The truth was that behind the scenes, Bobby Kennedy, on the orders of his brother, was meeting with the Soviet ambassador, and they were agreeing on a very explicit quid pro quo. We will take our missiles out of Turkey, our Jupiter missiles out of Turkey, if you take your missiles out of Cuba. Only he knew if it looked like a tit for tat, the Kennedys wouldn't look so good. They would have looked like they were just trading away things rather than standing up to the Russians. So it wasn't until about 40 years later when Robert McNamara, the then Secretary of Defense in Cuba, decided to blow the whistle that we knew the true story. So how we got into the crisis, what he did during the crisis, and how we got out of it all were twisted a little bit to tell the version that made America, and by the way, made the Kennedy family, look a little bit better than it should have.
Tomorrow we'll continue my conversation with Larry Tye about his new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon.